Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast. I'm Dave Etler, and this time we're going to introduce you to two of the people fighting worldwide epidemics, those of diabetes and obesity. Now, endocrinologist Dr. Dale Abel is the director of the University of Iowa Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes Research Center. And the Diabetes Research Center recently invited Dr. Miguel Lopez to come from Spain, where he is a professor of physiology at the University of Santiago de Compostela, where he coordinates the neuroobesity research group at the Center for Research in Molecular Medicine and Chronic Diseases. His field of knowledge is hypothalamic regulation of energy balance. Eric Wilson, Aline Sanduk, and Taz Khalid got to talk to them about the current state of research in diabetes and obesity and the prospects for a paradigm shift in how we treat them.
So thanks for joining us. And I just want to start things out by asking a little bit about your research, Dr. Lopez, and to you, you know, Dr. Abel, on this question as far as what made you bring Dr. Lopez in, and also, if you could give a little bit of a synopsis, maybe as close to you can in layman's terms, for what your research is and how could people in the wider world understand what it does.
I'm mainly working to investigate how the hypothalamus, how the brain controls energy balance. You know that several parts in the brain, and the hypothalamus is one of them, is controlling how calories are being eaten and are being used by the body, and I try to learn how these neurons in that particular brain area control this, trying to understand the system and trying to find targets to treat obesity. This is the main focus of my research.
So just to sort of add to that, so you know, obesity is a global epidemic, and there are probably more people who are obese and overweight now than undernourished in the world. And if you think about that, we're really seeing a tremendous explosion in type 2 diabetes and its complications. Therefore, one of the major goals of our Diabetes Research Center at the University of Iowa is to try to understand what goes wrong in terms of in the brain and elsewhere to really increase individuals' risk of obesity. And in the Diabetes Center, we have a very collaborative research approach, and one of the ways that we do that is that we invite experts from all over the world and all over the country to come and visit us in the Diabetes Center to interact with researchers here, to share their findings and to increase the collaborations that we have, and that way I think it will move the science and the research forward much more quickly.
I know that there were many reasons that we were very excited to have you come and speak and have Dr. Abel join us. One of them, kind of more of a philosophical perspective, is that it's possible that a lot of diabetes research and obesity research has been held back by this notion that people become obese just by a sheer lack of will or some sort of character defect where they just can't control the way that they eat or their lifestyles. And you're showing that there are legitimate measurable changes at the molecular level that can explain why people become obese and become victims of diabetes.
I agree. I think that until probably 25 years ago, the notion was that, you know, that poor obese people, that they can control themselves and they eat a lot. But we don't know that, despite the fact that the style of life have a deep impact in our phenotype, in our obesity phenotype, there are problems, there are molecular problems that can explain most of the obesity forms, no? Because we are talking about a complex disease. It's like cancer. It's not just a unique origin for obesity. It's several origins that can explain this accumulation of calories as fat. No? Mm-hmm. Then, yeah, I think that this notion is important, and society needs to know that in addition to the lifestyles, there is a molecular basis for that, and a lot of investment and a lot of research should be focused in that direction.
Yeah. You may have heard the maybe we have an obesity problem in the United States.
Worldwide.
Worldwide, for sure.
Worldwide. But, in Spain, we also have a lot of obese people, especially yeah. children, which is very dangerous because children, obese mm-hmm. children, they will probably have more problems in the future in terms of obesity, diabetes, and other comorbidities. Then this is worldwide. In Europe and also in Spain in particular, we have a serious problem with obesity mm-hmm. between everybody, sure. and children.
Sure.
Going off of what Aline just talked about, this question would also be some sort of philosophical or more of a public health issue, that when you talk about obesity and, you know, malnutrition or with patients, one of the things that bring up is I can't control it. It's just the way I am and that's how I eat. Just out of, like, you know, as a professional in your field or just as a societal issue, how would you talk about dealing with this issue and, like, talking to people about, you know, just letting them know that this is a lot more problematic than they think it is? And any comments on that?
It's not easy. It's not easy because they are how they are, because their genes or their molecules are telling them to work in that way. However, I think it's important to explain them which is the problem and trying to offer therapeutic solutions. No? I remember that I was in Cambridge about 4 months ago. I made my postdoc there and I came back for visiting people there. And someone told me that they have a big cohort of people being mutants of the NC4 receptor, and they are obese. And they explained to people that they are mutants of this protein, and they gave them T-shirts telling, "I am NC4 mutant," no? And this is the reason why, because I have this problem. And it's good to know that they have this. They are that way, but they are the way because they didn't choose that. They were also probably unlucky with the genes that they got, but it's not really their fault. It's like being probably tall, more clever, or it's just a matter of genes. Of course, the environment is very important, right. And we are living a very obesogenic environment.
Yeah,
it's also important. But and this thing is very well designed because our biological system is being designed for a situation of famine and not a huge amount of resources. 20,000 years ago, it was probably difficult to find obese people, no?
Right.
Because the system wants to keep calories. But in an environment like this, this increases the problem.
And so just add to that as well. So, you know, Miguel mentioned that there are patients who have known mutations. I think if you look at the entire universe of individuals with obesity, we still don't know the genetics for the majority. And so what that means then is that we still have quite a ways to go to sort of understanding what the fundamental biology is. And as we learn more, then I think we'll be in a better position to predict more and a better position to perhaps to have more targeted treatments. That being said, we do know that there's a convergence between this, as Miguel said, this obesogenic environment. I mean, there's food everywhere, right? And so, you know, by helping individuals, even if they don't necessarily know what their risk is, to understand that we do interact with our environments in ways that, you know, provide a challenge. And I think we also need to take a somewhat societal view to actually ask the big questions. Well, what are the foods which are being presented to society which are inexpensive but calorically dense? Is this really the best model? You know, certainly, you know, economically, you can do very well from the standpoint of producing these things in a way that's cheap and dense, but is that really the best thing for society? Or, for example, when we look at the way that we build communities, should we really be encouraging communities that are more walkable? Things that will, you know, increase the likelihood of people having behaviors that would, in fact, increase energy expenditure. And then once that becomes woven into the fabric of what you do, then it becomes somewhat second nature. And so I think we really have to attack it both from the molecular level, but we also have to realize that there are societal things that we can also do to begin to have an impact.
I was going to say the same thing. Like, we do have a lot of food, but then what food is healthy and what food is not? Like, the fast food culture is, that's, in my opinion, is one of the big things that's causing, you know, this such an obesity epidemic and a lot of other things too, like canned foods. And people actually don't have time in our today's world and, you know, day and age that they can actually cook proper healthy foods and mm-hmm. then just go out and eat, and then all the other chemicals and nutrients in the food that may or may not be, you know, good for them. So
I thought that was a really great point, actually. We talk a lot about fast food culture and convenience. And so kind of building on that, I was wondering if either of you are involved, I mean, clearly you're involved in the clinical setting and the research setting. Do either of you do any advocacy work or any public health work to translate what you're finding into a setting where it could actually meaningfully change culture or society? I know it's a big question.
No, it's a big question. So I'm going to make a couple of responses, and then Miguel, I'm sure, will have something to add as well. There are different levels of advocacy. So on a personal level, I've been involved in advocacy, really lobbying, particularly at the level of the government, for really increased funding, not only for obesity research, but importantly, also for reimbursement for obesity management. I mean, believe it or not, only just very recently are physicians actually being reimbursed for obesity counseling, because for a long time, obesity wasn't really viewed by those who pay for healthcare as a disease, quotes unquote, and therefore it wasn't something that should be paid for, quotes unquote. So so that's certainly one important aspect. I think the other thing I can share, this is not personal, but really institutionally, that there are a number of members within the Diabetes Center and also in the Obesity Initiative here on campus who are very active in community-based advocacy that ultimately seeks to have an impact on obesity, certainly within the states and potentially nationally. I think there are probably, I can think of 5, 6, 7 faculty members who are doing things, for example, like going into schools, looking at school lunches, things like that. One person actually got a grant funded to actually look at the impact of the Affordable Care Act on restaurant menus and the extent to which that potentially might change behavior. One of the persons looking at your office environment, you know, are there ways that we can actually get people to move more within their offices and take a look at that? So there are people who are really thinking very hard about things like that. And, you know, we're trying to get the word out to those individuals who make policy to actually realize that these are important things. And although you can't necessarily see a return investment the next day, that if you look at the cost over many years, that, you know, a modest investment now ultimately may have a significant impact in, you know, years and decades to come.
I agree with this point. I think it's very important education. Small children also go to the schools. We have in Santiago de Compostela also visit to the schools, programs, go to the children, tell them to move a little bit more, to eat healthy. This is the key. Education is the key. I come from a country which is politically very complicated. You know, all the problems we have in Spain is people wanting to split. And yeah. education, since you are very young, is very important gang for good and bad things. No? If you tell people something when they are young, you can combine them very easily. And I think that this is one of the keys. I agree with Dale's point. Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's very encouraging, especially as future clinicians, because I mean, I will also be doing a PhD shortly, and so I'm hoping also to get involved in advocacy. But one of the biggest challenges I think that we face as future physicians is, you know, translating these findings in a way that patients can understand, in a way that their employers and their healthcare payers can understand.
So that's definitely what attracted me to having this discussion today, as somebody who is going into family medicine, and I know I'm going to see, like, I don't even know how many, but almost, you know, many of my patients will have diabetes. Many of them will be obese.
Sure.
And I was just really interested in hearing your perspectives on this topic and kind of looking at where the basic science is. But wondering also in my future as a clinician working with these populations, do you see anything changing in the next 20 years as far as how we treat patients with diabetes, how we treat patients with obesity? Is there something that I'm going to have to be learning as a primary care physician that is going to really change my view on how we deal with these conditions?
So I think the answer is yes. I think things are actually moving very rapidly. In my career, I've seen the number of medications, for example, available to manage diabetes increase probably tenfold. So there's going to be an increase as we understand new targets. There'll be new agents that you're going to have to keep up with. I think the other piece which is important, and you'll see this, and I'm sure you've probably already seen this in your training, is that obesity surgery is now really becoming increasingly recognized as an effective tool to help the more severely affected individuals reduce weight. Importantly, may cure diabetes, for example, and things like that. Now, if you think about that, though, you can't do obesity surgery on, you know, hundreds of millions of people, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to kind of figure out in your own practice who are the patients who really need that sooner rather than later, who are the ones that potentially can have significant impacts by working with, you know, lifestyle modification and so forth. And then I think the other piece, which is important, again, for U.S. medical students to recognize, and I think Iowa is actually very strong at this sort of team-based approach, is that, you know, there will never be enough physicians to manage the extent of the burden that is really growing in terms of, you know, obesity and type 2 diabetes. Therefore, we have to establish teams where the teams might be physician-led, certainly, but we will have to have nurses, wellness coaches, a variety of kinds of individuals. And in fact, this has to happen, for example, in family medicine, mm-hmm. right? In primary care, where you really have to create an environment where you don't necessarily need a physician to manage every aspect of somebody's lifestyle as it relates to their body weight. And even when they develop diabetes, our most successful patients with diabetes are those who ultimately take ownership of their condition and manage themselves. And so I think the approach that, well, you know, that the doctor says, therefore patient does, is it's going to be a challenge to practice that way to have the biggest impact.
I like to think that we are now in the obesity field the same level that the cancer field was probably 25, 30 years ago. And all this time, the cancer treatment and the life expectation of people with cancer has improved a lot. Mm-hmm. Then in our field, I think we are a little bit delayed if we compare with the cancer field. And definitely I agree Dale's point about this. I think that in the years to come, the number of treatments to control diabetes and obesity will increase, and the quality of life of our patients will increase for sure. Then your future is brilliant and very exciting, I would say.
That's great to hear.
Yeah. I have a question. This goes again to like political boundaries and you know, geographical distances. So you're from Spain and you're originally from Western East, was practicing here. Mm-hmm. Just to comment on how obesity and diabetes is being tackled across the Atlantic in the European countries and in the US, and collaborations between these two, you know, research capitals of the world, if you may.
Yeah, so, you know, what I would say in terms of what's happening here in North America is that certainly people are talking about it a lot more. You know, you never, a week doesn't go by when there's some major piece in some, whether it's a big newspaper, whether it's on the news. So I think the public awareness of this issue is becoming more and more important. I think as physicians, the comfort level to actually speak frankly with patients about their weight is probably also improving, because, you know, historically sometimes doctors are afraid to directly address that issue with patients because you're afraid that you may offend or hurt somebody's feeling or something like that. America has a number of political challenges as well, as Spain does, and it's becoming rather acute in the next few months, I'm sure. But nevertheless, I think one of the challenges that we have, and I'll give you a couple of examples of this, is that changing public policy in the United States is sometimes easier said than done. Why? So there's a federal government that really controls relatively few things. I mean, a lot of the day-to-day governing is done at the state and the local level. And so, for example, it'll be challenging, you know, under the current model for somebody to say in Washington, okay, everybody's going to eat a certain way across the entire country. And we can only imagine that the revolt that would cause in state A, B, or C, because individuals are, you know, really have very strong feelings about their autonomy. So how do you change that? You change that by increasing public understanding and awareness so that you kind of get a more of a kind of a grassroots effect to their lawmakers, talking to their politicians and so forth to actually, you know, bring about some of these changes. So I think it's going to be challenging. And then the other aspects, for example, I mean, we live in Iowa. Historically, a lot of the high fructose corn syrup originated in the
what?
Soils.
Corn and iron.
Right, originated in the soils of this state, and you know there are political reasons why that's not in everything you every label you're gonna see that, you know, and it's gonna take a while to kind of work that out politically, right? So I think that that's some of the challenges that we face. But I think that to the extent to which we are having these conversations, and to the extent to which, you know, people will actually speak up to their elected officials, then I think that's how we'll gradually see change. So that's how I see things evolving, at least in North America.
I think it's the same case in Europe, and Spain in particular. Politicians and political decisions, at least now, the politics in my country know that the obesity problem is a problem, mm-hmm. and there is a biological basis for that. And they are becoming more and more used to that message, and the investment in science and in this particular part of medicine is increasing. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's not increased at the level that we want, and it's very far away of the level of that you have here in US. The investment in science in Spain is, I think, about 0.5% of the PIB. And here it's about 3 or...
It's a little bit more, yeah. More. But again, you know, I think it can be more, I think.
I wouldn't complain if I would have 3%. Right. but improving. The problem that we have in my country, if you compare Spain with, for example, States, UK or Germany, is that we don't have scientific tradition. In Spain, a lot of people want to play football, want to be singer, want to be an actress.
But that sounds like us too.
Yeah. But if you go to the school, there is not really a. There are good students, of course, as everywhere, but there is not a motivation, or there is not for being scientists, for being. And this is something that we are trying to change, but it takes generation to change. Then we are a little bit more delayed if we compare with traditional. Scientifically traditional countries as the States, UK, or Germany. This is the main problem. Mm. Society, which is your job? I work in the university. What do you research? Really? Do you research? Yeah.
Unusual.
Yeah, I do research. It's not usual there. Then we are trying to change that, but we are probably 25, 30 years. Mm. We have all the dictatorship in Spain for almost 40 years from the 1936 to 1975, and this produced some delay in terms of this kind of thing. We are trying to go faster, and I think we are doing reasonably well. But
I was going to say, you both make excellent faces to the movement, and I think you are making a commitment to this change, not just in word, but indeed through your research, your clinical work, your advocacy.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can see, coming back to Taz's question earlier, I can see how this collaboration maybe carries more weight than just the exchange of information, especially if you're establishing more of a research culture, having these connections and just showing that this can be a prominent part of a university culture is this very
hopefully.
Serious scientific research. To me now, it seems like that seems to be part of the visit here as well, to kind of bring
Definitely.
Back some sort of research capital, I guess.
Yeah.
And I just add though, I mean, so he, Miguel, has collaborated well with one of our faculty members here, Kamal Ramuni, for mm-hmm. what, how many years?
Almost 10 years.
Yeah, about 10 years. And, you know, together they have published some amazing papers that have really changed the field. And if we actually go back, so his postdoc mentor was a postdoc with me back in Boston, back in the last century. And in fact, the last time we saw each other was when I was over in Cambridge almost a decade ago.
Yeah.
You know, so these connections,
cross-pollination.
So there are all these, you can, there's like probably only like 2 degrees of separation sometimes once you actually, you know, draw the lineage back to where we're going. But by continuing this sort of free exchange of ideas and time, then it becomes just this increasingly complex matrix that ultimately I think the impact will be hopefully bigger than the sum of its parts.
I was going to say, I think science is it's a small community, but it's a very dedicated community. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interest in collaborating because I think not just in science, but maybe in medicine too, the days of the solo practitioner are over. I mean, just the level of knowledge that we've accrued necessitates many different people with different expertise working together. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to some of the factors that promote cross-Atlantic collaboration, if specifically if it helps to bring different money to the table, to really encourage collaboration. That may not, maybe
yeah, so
we should
well,
just
I, I'll just make
question.
A quick response and then, so science is not global. So, you know, mm-hmm. you publish a paper today, I see it on PubMed, I can have it, I can read it literally almost the minute it comes out,
yeah.
right? Number one, you know, we spend time going to meetings, whether here, whether in Europe, whether elsewhere. So the culture has always been one of sharing data as we come to understand a particular area. And so that alone will bring collaborations. Funding still tends for the most part to be regional. So, you know, funding in Europe tends to fund Europe, funding in North America tends to fund research in North America. There are a few transatlantic collaborative efforts. The one I'm most familiar with is something called the LADUC, which is mm-hmm. a cardiovascular mm-hmm. network that funds grants every year between Europe and the US. And in fact, sort of parenthetically, Iowa has had a long history of success in this. Mark Anderson was one when he was here. Then Frank Ferracci, who is on faculty here, is a participant in another transatlantic LADUC network looking at high blood pressure. So there are some specific mechanisms that will fund across the Atlantic, but I think in the big scheme they're relatively few. But I think what happens though is that the collaborations, if I can help your science and you can get a grant in Europe, you can help my science get a grant
yeah.
here, then the net effect is still progress, although the funds might be, you know, relatively discrete.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, just looking at the technology that we have, and like you had mentioned, Dr. Abel, about put a paper on PubMed and you see it that day if you do a search, or you have an alert set up to see any new papers that come out. And what's amazing to me is thinking back, recently I was reading about the AIDS epidemic when it first came to the United States in the 80s, and I felt internally very frustrated by what seemed like people were doing very similar research in many different areas, but the pathways for sharing that research weren't, they may have been well developed, but it wasn't as fast and immediate as it seems like now, where if we have important discoveries that are coming out about mm-hmm. obesity or diabetes, these can be shared very quickly with the rest of the world.
Science is a very competitive field, and you know, people always are afraid about sharing the new data and the new stuff, but still I think that the benefits of sharing data and the sharing information are greater than the benefit that you don't have if you hide that information. Then I think that it's very important to keep collaborating internationally and also in your own country. You have here a lot of opportunities to collaborate with very good groups mm-hmm. in this field. In Spain we are not so many, probably 10 or 8 groups doing more or less well in the field, but we are trying to be competitive at international levels. Of course, I would love to have this LADUC Foundation program. It's a fantastic initiative to fund collaboration between Europe and North America, but I agree that most of the funding we get in Spain is from Spain or Europe. I never applied for American funding, and I don't think I could be competitive.
It would be pretty tough.
For,
I mean,
for an NIH grant, for example.
A very narrow mechanism, but you have to like jump through 10 hoops to even
yeah.
convince them that nobody in America is doing that.
Yeah.
Sure. I wonder if this helps, though, to have people in different regions bring different money to the table and augment each other's work using money that one researcher doesn't have to apply for, if that makes sense.
Sure. I think, like I said earlier, that, you know, if you share an idea with me that helps what I'm doing, and I share an idea with you that helps what you're doing, and we both can
and
then be competitive locally,
yeah.
then I think that's a win-win for both of us.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, really, no matter what type of doctor you are, you're going to be a obesity doctor, and you're going to be a diabetes doctor, whether mm-hmm. it's pediatrics, adults, anything. It's so prevalent in our culture that everybody has to deal with it. So from that sense, it seems like the small amounts of, you know, small percentage of funding that Dr. Lopez, you and Dr. Abel are talking about, it seems even smaller given the immensity of this problem.
So disproportionate almost.
Yeah. I think so. I think that How old are you now? 20.
I'm 28. I'm 28. A little bit older.
You are still very young, but I think that in the next years you will become experts in obesity and diabetes, not only in the States, everywhere in the world. That is something that we need to control, but hopefully we are in good hands. I feel relaxed because when I see my students now in Spain, they are much better prepared now than I was 25 years ago. I'm 43 now. And
really?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll have to keep you afterwards to give us the secrets of your great skin. In addition to some weight loss secrets, which is the real reason that we
It is the first time that someone tells me that. Thank you. I'm more worried about my hair, which is becoming white, but I know, thank you very much.
Sure.
But yeah, I feel relaxed about the... I think that the future is in good hands here and also there.
I wanted to thank you, actually, for raising this point, because having gone to your talk, I realized how much of a groundbreaker you've been in this area. And effectively, your students are going to be so well prepared to tackle the next phase of this problem because you've provided them with such great training and mentorship and guidance and things like that. So,
But I'm trying to do what I learned from my mentors, Carlos Diaguez in Spain, Tony Villalpuch in Cambridge, Steve O'Reilly. I think that the key point for being a good mentor is being generous with people. Share research, share data, and trying to understand that you are working with people and they have feelings and and you need to deal with all this. And it's very important to allow people to be creative. A research team where the PI is the only creative person will never work well or will never be competitive. It's very important too, because sometimes if you look the better ideas or the best ideas are coming from young people that not necessarily know all the things you know, because they see things easier. More than 10 years ago, when I thought about this story about the thyroid hormones acting in the brain, my knowledge about thyroid hormones wasn't really high. And I can understand now, my knowledge has increased, how I could have that idea at that time. Mm-hmm. And I cannot probably have the idea this time, because I know so many things, much more things about thyroid hormones acting peripherally that I would never imagine that they could be acting through the brain. And in that time, I don't really know too much about thyroid hormones acting in the periphery. I knew some things, but not the stuff I know now. And this could make me imagine that they could be acting through the hypothalamus. Mm. Then it's very important to allow people to be creative.
That's such a wonderful perspective to have as a mentor. It almost seems like what you're suggesting is that to be younger is to be less realistic, which provokes some of these grandiose ideas that maybe as we get older, we get a little too logical to imagine things working this
but
way.
If you think about the history of science, some of the biggest ideas that people had, Einstein, Heisenberg, they had Newton, they proposed all these ideas when they were almost all of them less than 40, because it's the moment when you are much more creative. Afterwards, you become more involved in politics, you have children, you are more busy. It's very important. Your most productive time for you as creative people is starting now.
Mm. I think this echoes off by the idea that the best ideas are simply sometimes the simplest ideas.
Yeah.
That you talked about Einstein and Newton, like now they talk about it in news all the time that their theories were pretty simple, but they were so grand that nobody thought of them at that time except those who did.
Yeah.
So the idea and the fact that you said that a true mentor is who, you know, transitions his knowledge or her knowledge to their students and then let them think out of the box and then go from there. So yeah, I've had some great mentors in my life as well, and some not, you know, both ends of the spectrum, but I respect both of them. Actually, they both taught me a lot more than I, you know, would have thought at the time. So.
When you become a mentor, always let people grow. It's very important, because they will always appreciate that. If you are a good student, you will always appreciate and recognize what your mentor has done for you. Always. It's important.
And we really appreciate you coming and talking with us.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you for considering me for this nice experience. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, that's it. Thanks for hanging out with us today, listeners. If you like what you hear, go to iTunes, whether you use iTunes or not, and give us a review there. The reviews help us grow the show, make us feel good. And as always, we're listening all over the place. So send us an email at theshortcoats@gmail.com or hit us up on Facebook or Twitter or use one of the other options that appears on theshortcoat.com/tell us. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. And we're still in the market for another. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by AgriFox. Talk to you in 1 week.